This is Regionally Speaking, it's Reporter Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's check in with Will Rackey, who is the Lake County Government reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Will, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Let's start out with the newest story that we have out there in print and online. This is about a visit today by a rather famous federal judge. Tell us what Judge Gonzalo Curiel is going to talk about at Purdue Northwest.
Well, he's coming to speak in a town hall forum, and the kind of the theme of the forum is called From the Region to the Federal Bench. So, you know, he's gonna focus on kind of his journey, his humble origins, beginning in East Chicago, and kind of how he was able to go to law school and become a lawyer, and he was eventually appointed as a district court judge, U.S. District Court judge by former President Obama. So that's going to be kind of a big focus of his talk. But, you know, there will also be some questions, and students will be able to ask him just kind of about his career and about legal issues that are prominent today. So it should be a pretty wide-ranging talk at Purdue University Northwest today.
Now, why is Judge Curiel best known, I suppose? He, I guess, just did very well as a journeyman judge on the federal district court bench out in California, but it was apparently one incident not long ago that must have gotten him in the news. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was back in 2016 during the presidential campaign, and, of course, at that time, one of Trump's central campaign promises was that he was going to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. And while that was happening, there were some lawsuits against Trump University, and Judge Curiel was presiding over those. And so he made some rulings in those cases, basically giving the plaintiffs class action status and a few other rulings that were not favorable to the Trump Organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, Trump, who was a candidate at the time, he essentially suggested that perhaps Curiel was biased against him because of his Mexican heritage in light of Trump's promise to build that wall. So that was kind of the origin of the dispute there. Now, ironically, in subsequent lawsuits against Trump as the Trump administration after Trump was elected, Curiel ruled in favor of the administration on a border wall case. So I'm not sure that that Trump's contention or suggestion that Curiel was biased had any water. It certainly didn't appear so, because he did rule in favor of Trump in a matter of law. So that was kind of that's the interesting backstory behind this, and I'm sure there will be questions about that.
I'm sure. One of the other stories that you had out there in print and online here lately talks about the Calumet Township Trustee's Office, and an interesting point here, it brings back a famous name in Northwest Indiana political history, an attorney who's from Gary, who's worked before with the Township Trustee's Office and the board. Tell us where Clorius Lay is fitting into the stories these days.
So, yeah, Clorius Lay is back in the news in local politics. Of course, he's running for an at-large Gary Council seat in the primary this May.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a political candidate. He has, in addition to his law practice, he has been in politics for many years. He was a former Calumet Township Board of Trustee member. So, and what has kind of put him back in the news is that he was recently hired by the Calumet Township Trustee's Office to monitor legislative efforts in the State House having to do with allowing the town of Griffith to secede from Calumet Township. So that's kind of the context.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people are questioning whether that hire was ethical or wise. This is Kim Robinson, who is the Calumet Township trustee who made the hire. And she's been criticized by Darren Washington, who is on the township board and believes that hiring Clorius Lay kind of smacks of cronyism and was not the right move to make.
I understand that Washington was I guess upset too, because they figure that's just more money that they have to spend in Calumet Township for hiring another consultant, so to speak, when they have already had some help on the way to work on this deal with the town of Griffith.
Right. So Darren Washington was adamant that this was an unnecessary hire, especially because the Indiana Township Association is working with Calumet Township to combat this legislation that's pending in the State House. And now what this legislation would do would allow Griffith to administer its own township services, and thereby allowing it to essentially complete its secession from Calumet Township. But the Calumet Township already has people working on this. You know, that's Washington's contention, and he's questioning why Kim Robinson would pay Clorius Lay to essentially do the same work.
Mm-hmm.
And the other interesting thing with this hire is that Clorius Lay had previously sued Calumet Township over some unpaid legal bills and won a judgment, and he has also been a critic of Kim Robinson in public, questioning some of her decisions, especially her decision to take a taxpayer-funded junket to Aruba, I believe it was.
Yeah.
So, you know, Washington's contention is that you have somebody who has a checkered history, essentially, with the Calumet Township, and somebody who has had personal conflicts with the current trustee. So it doesn't look good to have him come back and to pay him for work that somebody else is already doing. So that's Washington's contention.
Yeah, it sounds like you know, they're trying to bury the hatchet, so to speak, and just to make it expeditious to get an extra little legal voice in the matter when there's already plenty of legal voices out there dealing with the secession issues, to be sure. So it'll be interesting to see how that shapes up here in the weeks ahead about that, too. Speaking of ethics, you had a chance to catch the Ethics Summit here not long ago and listen to the keynote speaker, a very distinguished gentleman in his own right. Tell us about the session and about the keynote speaker, the U.S. Attorney for Northwest Indiana.
Right. So the session was the annual summit of the Shared Ethics Advisory Commission, and the keynote speaker was Thomas Kirsch, who is the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Indiana. And by way of background, the Shared Ethics Advisory Commission has been going on for a decade or so now, and it was founded by some citizens in the region who were concerned that there was a lack of ethics awareness and training in the public sector throughout the region. And of course, there is a long and undistinguished list of Lake County officials who have been prosecuted and many of them sent to jail over corruption issues. And this goes back many years, of course. So the Shared Ethics Advisory Commission works with local governments at the county and municipal level to kind of instill some ethical training and better ethical decision-making among public officials. And they held their annual summit last week in Merrillville, and Thomas Kirsch was there, you know, delivering a keynote address. And kind of the main points of his address were that that ethics training and ethics awareness is a first line of defense against the kind of pervasive corruption and wrongdoing that Lake County and some other areas in the region have seen from its public officials.
Well, it sounds like it must have been a very great speech, and I understand that there are a lot of people there, so they probably got quite a bit of education of their own right by listening to what the U.S. Attorney Kirsch had to say, to be sure. One of the other stories, too, that you, Will Racky, with the Times of Northwest Indiana, got to check out is some information from the Hammond Police Department. They've decided to kind of up their services in a way and make them more high-tech these days with a new smartphone app. Tell us about that and what this concept of a digital neighborhood watch is all about.
Right. So, of course, police departments are always looking for ways to kind of adopt new technologies into how they approach crime. And what Hammond has done is partnered with Ring. Ring is a company that makes a very popular home security system, camera and lighting systems. They're actually owned by Amazon. Mm-hmm. But what Ring has done is developed an app that is free to be downloaded. You don't have to be. You don't have to use Ring cameras to use it. And what this app does is it allows neighbors in a community to upload photos, videos, text messages into a essentially a community board that the police also have access to. And it's basically just a way to report suspicious activity or potential crimes to police, and also to receive information from police, so emergency messages, Amber alerts, basically anything that would be of interest to the community can be posted through this app. And so that's what Hammond has rolled out. I think that what right now it's just kind of it's in its early stages, but they're hoping that that residents will download this app and just use it as another way to share information with each other and with the police department.
It sounds like it's another way to, because they have regular neighborhood watch meetings in the neighborhoods around Hammond, and the city encourages them to have these meetings to get the word out and talk about some of the problems in their particular neighborhood. So this is, a way to kind of bring it up and bring these topics up on a more frequent basis rather than setting up a meeting to get everybody all together in one room to talk about these things, to be sure.
I think what they are looking at, based on my conversations with Hammond Police spokesman, was that so many people, especially of a younger generation, use their mobile phones to do just about everything that you can think of. And so they just wanted to extend that concept to the neighborhood watch, especially for people who can't always attend certain meetings. This is just a way for them to be connected if they can't. But they can't show up in person. So that was the kind of the intent that I got from police spokesman, okay. From a police spokesperson.
I know one of your major jobs as being the Lake County government reporter for the Times is to cover some of the county government meetings. One of course, is the Lake County Council, and they had a meeting here not long ago. It took up a number of items, I understand, but one in particular was a business-related item that would, if it would happen, which apparently is not now, because they've decided to put the kibosh on plans to rezone some land in St. John. Tell us what that was all about.
Right. So at the last council meeting, which was on Tuesday, the council rejected a petition to rezone some land in unincorporated Lake County that's kind of on the borderline of St. John. Mm-hmm. And what the petitioner wanted was to rezone that land from residential use to rural business use in order to put up a Dollar General store. Now, this land or this parcel is on 101st Street, about a half mile east of the state line. So it's not in a developed area, but it is in an area where there has been some relatively newer residential development. So yeah. It's in kind of a growing area.
Yeah, they've been building up a lot of subdivisions out that way, and it's also, since it's close to the state line, there'd be a lot of business that would come in from folks that live in Illinois too.
Exactly. Councilman Christian Jorgensen, who is a Republican town council, Republican county councilman, was opposed to this essentially from the beginning. He's been opposed to it for a while, and at his urging, the council unanimously voted to reject that zoning change, which had been approved by the county plan commission. So this was the county council overturning the plan commission. Now Jorgensen's reasoning was that the council has kind of a greater scope of review, meaning that they take into consideration more long-term or broader effects of these zoning decisions than the zoning board does. And he was saying that that St. John, the town of St. John, already has a dollar store, and it's kind of more core downtown area, so there wasn't a need for another one. And he also contended that this would worsen traffic on that 101st Avenue corridor, which is already, he says, getting worse because of the development, the residential development there. And he was concerned that it wouldn't have any positive effect on property values in that area. Of course, Jorgensen lives in St. John, and he is very protective of the town's development interests in his role as a county councilman.
Well, I guess it shows that some, for those people who think that these issues involving zoning are oftentimes just rubber stamped, that a plan commission will make a recommendation and the county government, in this case, will just go along with it without thinking otherwise or just without even looking at it, I suppose. Well, it shows it doesn't always happen, that they can make up their minds and make the, and sometimes it's not to the benefit of the petitioner, to say the least, to be sure. So, Will Racky is a Lake County government reporter for The Times. In fact, this is your first opportunity to be with us on Regionally Speaking, and thank you very much for joining us here. And we hope to have a chance to talk with you again about some stories from Northwest Indiana's largest county in the future. Thanks for being with us today, Will.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate it and look forward to talking to you again.
And Reporters Roundtable Thursday continues on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's check in with Greg Tejeda. He covers stories in the city of Gary for the Post-Tribune. And as always, Greg, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, let's start out here with the story of interest to hear about Dollar General and the Gary Redevelopment Commission. What's that all about?
2 months ago, the Redevelopment Commission gave approval, turned over a plot of land on Brighton Broadway near the heart of downtown.
Mm-hmm.
That the city had control over. They're going to, Dollar General wants to build one of their stores. And under the agreement, Dollar General is paying like, I think it's $175,000. And they have 6 months to get construction started or else the land reverts back to the city. What happened was that the company is asking for a little more time, and now they're being given close to a year before they have to get construction started. The city views it as they're being cooperative, and they ultimately they'll get a new business in town.
Mm-hmm.
Although there are some people who want to stir up how should I describe this? They want to stir up talk that somehow there's a plot involved, that somehow the city is hurting itself, and they're giving away land to a company, which caused some of the Redevelopment Commission officials to start, you know, it got ugly at the last Redevelopment Commission
uh-huh.
hearing. You know, they were starting to accuse each other, you know, of all kinds of nasty things, you know, stirring up lies, you know, all kinds of... It got absurd.
I understand. Yeah, I got to a point where there were some accusations from one activist about all this, and then from Redevelopment Commission members against him, I understand.
Yes, yes. And, of course, they started to bring out the fact that this particular activist who owns plots of land is behind on his... property taxes, so they're going out of their way to take cheap shots at each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting to come out
government,
like this.
Gary government at its finest.
Yeah. So it sounds interesting, to say the least here. Looking at something that is not necessarily a redevelopment, at least land-related, it's street-related, it's pothole cleanup. Tell us about what City of Gary wants to do to try to fix up some of the bumpy streets.
They got a grant from the Indiana Department of Transportation help pay for all these expenses. They've got something like, I think it's 18 different streets around the city, scattered around, that are particularly pothole infested. They started the repair work last week, and this is going to be running through the summer. They're mm-hmm. going to be patching up potholes, resurfacing these streets, trying to make Gary's roads a lot more passable.
I know one in particular that has been pretty bumpy, which I take on occasion, is 45th Street in the Glen Park neighborhood. It's had a lot of potholes, and I noticed the other day that the crews have already been out to mill down the street. So there are no potholes there, but they haven't replaced the pavement yet, which I'm guessing that'll come in time. They'll get through and work on that stretch. That's on the list I know that they're doing right now.
Right. They're saying that they're hoping that by the end of May, the bulk of this will be started up. But there's going to be work taking place all the way through the end of September.
Mm-hmm.
You know, related to this.
Is there, if anybody's sent, I guess they had the list already set up for this year, but I guess people can check in and find out if their area is going to be worked on, maybe some rough idea when it's going to happen, if they haven't seen something already?
Yes, people are being asked to call the city's 311 line, where they will supposedly give you an update as to when they hope to get around your area. And they're also willing to take your suggestions for future repairs if and when they get more funds from the state.
Let's continue on with some of the latest coming out of Gary Common Council. One story that you had out there in print and online talked about the Common Council transferring some money to help improve the city's image. Tell us about that.
Councilman Mike Protho every year has this picnic for the people who live in his district. It's meant to bring the people out, and he always goes out and raises funds to help pay for it. Anyway, it turns out that from the last 2 years, he had a little over $1,900 left over in money in his portion of the budget. So what they've decided to do is take that money and transfer it to where they hopefully can use it to promote some other event that might benefit the city of Gary's public image. They haven't decided yet which event. There actually are some people who've hinted that maybe it could somehow help bring back the air show. Whether or not that happens, you know, that's yet to be determined. But the idea is they have $1,900 of cash sitting around. They want to use it. They want to put it to some use.
Well, I suppose, yeah, $1,900 couldn't do much as far as immediately being able to bring the Gary Air Show back. Certainly not this year, because we know that the mayor's already announced that they're going to skip a year and try for next year to bring the air show back to Marquette Park over the lake. But I guess it's always going to help out in one way or the other, too, to be sure.
They're still trying to figure out what they're going to do with it. And in fact, part of the problem is that Councilman Protho was actually recovering from surgery. They're waiting for him to come back, sort of be a part of the process of deciding what the money will be used for, because after all, they see it as he helped raise that money, so he should have a say. So that's part of what the delay is in terms of being able to say what will ultimately benefit.
Okay. One of the other stories, Greg, that you just had out in the Post-Tribune, again, comes into play with the Gary Common Council and about transferring some money around. And this one in particular is going to shift some money around to help go toward some municipal building maintenance costs. Tell us about that.
The city had been putting aside some money. They had $100,000 put aside. The idea was that they were going to need to do an upgrade of the phone system at City Hall. The idea was they were going to have to buy a whole lot of equipment. They were anticipating a major expense. And they figured out a way to actually lease access to a phone system. Came out a lot cheaper. So it's turned out they discovered they have $100,000 available. And at their next council meeting on Tuesday next week, they are expecting to approve a measure that will transfer that money to a fund within the budget. What will then be used for maintenance at various government buildings around the city. It's possible this money could wind up getting put towards upgrade to the air conditioning system at City Hall. But that specifically has yet to be determined. Basically, they figured out they have $100,000 extra, and they don't want to waste it.
Well, good point, especially if they have repairs for a number of buildings. We know that the city's had plans to want to lease some other space out, in particular to try to raise some money, too.
Yes. They're on the verge. They're hoping later this summer to announce a deal that would be building at 839 Broadway, which was once the Sears store in downtown Gary, will be sold off and a new buyer. You know, they'll be fully moved out of there.
It'll be interesting to find out, who the new buyer is, and to be sure what they're going to do with that, and to do more improvements along Broadway, to be sure. One of the other stories, too, Greg, that you had is some positive news for the Gary Fire Department. Some new forces joining the force. Tell us about that.
A new class was taken in last year, and they finally completed their training. 13 new firefighters in Gary. And what particularly gets local officials excited is that 9 of those 13 are actually Gary residents.
They're
actually born, raised, grew up in Gary. You know, unlike what city officials see as a problem of out-of-towners coming in, taking the jobs, they see that they actually got the fire department's getting a boost in personnel, and it's benefiting local residents. Now, you got some council members actually saying they're hoping that these particular firefighters will do their entire careers in Gary, that this will be a good lifelong hire.
Well, that's up to what the city, I'm sure, can do in helping keeping their salaries up and benefits up as well, too, and then we have to work all that in together into the budget, I suppose.
Yes, yes.
Well, it seems interesting that we have these. I know there has been concern in the past. I know about about people coming in out of towners, as it were, but to also be able to keep the firefighters to be able to stay in Gary.
Right. Indiana law says you only have to live within a county of where you work, and in a lot of cases, it's been younger people putting in their couple of years in Gary, and then getting a better paying fire department job in another town.
Well. It's an interesting development for the city of Gary, to be sure. Positive development, as we know that that's what the administration is looking for these days, certainly. And Greg Tejeda, thank you for spending time to talk about your stories today, and hope we'll have more to come up soon coming out of the city of Gary.
Thank you.
Greg Tejeda's reporter for the Post Tribune. And on this Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio's Regionally Speaking, let's check in with Carly Lanich. She is education reporter for The Times. And Carly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Well, one of the stories that you had in print and online out there is an interesting story that involves education and also medicine as well, too. You had a chance to talk with the medical director of emergency services over at Methodist Hospitals about the concerns that everybody have. Students are concerned about gun violence and the sad outcome that has happened elsewhere, luckily not in Northwest Indiana, knock on wood, that has happened with gun violence. Tell us what Dr. Michael McGee had to say and the reason that he got together with everybody in Hammond.
Dr. Mike McGee really has this interesting background. As you mentioned, he's a director of emergency services for Methodist, and really what led him to this week-long series of events we're seeing this week is his experiences working in the emergency room, just witnessing gunshots and stabbings being very prevalent in his area. So he, with the help of another trauma doctor, said essentially, we need to set out to make a difference and make a change. So 4 years ago, he founded this organization. It's called Pop on Youth Violence. And throughout the year, they host series of events to really, change the mindset of students in the region. And now they've expanded out even to some Chicago neighborhoods to change the mindset of what might be leading to some of this violence and really elevate student leaders to make a change. This week is a particularly special week for them because it is National Youth Violence Prevention Week.
Mm-hmm.
So that's led them to, we've seen a series of events leading up to yesterday, their culminating event in Hyde Park, where they had close to 2,000 students, I want to say, expected to attend a rally to connect students with other students who may be in that situation in the same shoes, and even providing some adult leaders to show, how you can come out on the other side of what can be some really tough situations growing up in certain neighborhoods with, influences with your fellow peers or in your family.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the chance to connect with him over at Gary White House earlier this week. And this was just one of nearly a dozen school rallies they'll be holding throughout the week to spread this message.
Yeah, I understand Dr. McGee and some of the other people are involved in the presentations are just going around and visiting a number of schools here in the region. I'm sure passing on the same message, and I understand that that they have been offering a challenge to the students at each of the schools they visit. Tell us what this challenge is all about.
So they're actually working with folks over at IU Northwest to track and follow decreases in student bullying in these schools that they're visiting. So IUN will work with those schools after the visits to see how these, if there's a change in mindset, if there's a change in how students correspond with one another, and they'll track that using data, report back to Dr. McGee, and then his foundation is going to provide a DJ party for two schools in Indiana and then two others in Illinois. I believe that'll be announced at a later event that they're hosting to kind of get in front of summer violence. So they're even continuing this out. They don't want to just put on a week of events, but they're really looking to address the problem across the board.
Yeah, it's a problem that certainly does not go away with just 1 week of observance of ways to think about it and awareness that it has to happen all the time, to be sure. So, well, going from IU Northwest to Purdue Northwest, one of the stories you had out there in print and online in the Times recently here talked about a little personnel change in the College of Business at Purdue Northwest. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. So they've had a vacancy for a little while at their College of Business. They've now selected Lawrence Hammer. He's coming from DePaul University. He has a broad range of experiences in the business field. He'll be heading up PNW's College of Business starting July 1st. His background, he's been an associate dean of the College of Commerce for DePaul. He's been in integrated marketing education programming there, and he's got an extended experience studying both business and marketing. So he'll bring a new face to the school. The university really seems to be rallying behind it, and it comes actually at an interesting time for the university. As my colleague Joe Pete reported, PNW is working with faculty task forces to really look at the future of the university. So that's something we'll be following as well through the summer as PNW is working on their strategic planning and bringing in some of these new faculty members.
That's great. That's great. Let's stay in the city of Hammond. In this case, we'll talk about the public school system in Hammond. We know that they're making some personnel changes too at the top, and they've had a recent meeting, one of several they had planned, and some they couldn't pull off because of other reasons, but they did happen to have one this past Tuesday night to talk about the person who the school board would like to have as the leader of the school district. Tell us about that meeting and a little bit more about Scott Miller.
Hammond, this is a story we've been following closely. As we know, Hammond is one of our largest school districts, certainly by student population.
Mm-hmm.
Their current superintendent, Walter Watkins, is approaching the end of his term as superintendent. He's retiring. He's been with the district for many, many years and actually extended his superintendentship. He announced his retirement about a year ago, actually extended through this summer to help the board find time to find their ideal candidate to replace him. They've now come forward with Scott Miller as a leading candidate. They've done a number of things to introduce him to the community, both in holding this public meeting to review his contract and in posting some information just about who he is as a person to their website. His background with the district, he's spent more than two decades in public education, most of those with the Hammond School District, and he comes from a tech background. He's currently principal of the Hammond Area Career Center, where he works with CTE programs and education programming to really lead technical training for students into the future. And now he's looking to broaden his scope, working as superintendent. So the district did meet on Tuesday of this week. This was a meeting to address questions of his contract, should it be approved. Final approvals will come in a board meeting next week where the board will vote whether to approve this contract.
Mm-hmm.
If they do, which is expected, Scott Miller will become the next superintendent of the district. So we'll be following this very closely.
Yeah. I know that he is going to be a very busy fella. He's probably, he knows some of the issues already since he's been involved with the Hammond Area Career Center, but he doesn't know them on the same scope as when you end up being the superintendent of the whole district. And I know that there have been a lot of problems that the school city of Hammond has been dealing with. A lot of it I know the Times has talked about in stories and online as well, too. And some of the residents of Hammond that showed up for that meeting where Miller was talking tried to get their two cents worth in, too, I guess, about some of the problems that they are sure that he's going to have to address. Tell us what the problems that are out there for the school city of Hammond and what the residents are concerned the most about.
Sure. So this did come out in the meeting on Tuesday, as has in past meetings in Hammond. Really what the district is faced with is not dissimilar to other districts. Schools are in a tough position looking at property tax caps going into effect in 2020. That's
mm-hmm.
Hitting schools hard with their funding that they'll be receiving publicly in the coming year. Hammond's also seen a decline in enrollment within the last year, which is difficult for districts in a state where the funding model follows the student. So even losing a handful of students can cost a district, you know, a couple thousand dollars in state funding. So that's something the district is really looking to balance. They know there's going to be a likelihood that they'll have to close some schools. I know Columbia and Lafayette Elementary have really been the center of those conversations. And so parents came out Tuesday, not necessarily with concerns directed towards Scott Miller, but with concerns that they hope the district leadership will hear and take forward as they continue planning. You mentioned kind of at the top of this conversation that there's been some meetings that haven't happened yet. That because bringing in new leadership, I think the district was really hoping to allow that leadership time to address kind of those concerns themselves, delve into the issues, and then come forward with that fresh face for the next meeting. So those meetings are expected to still continue to be planned. We're hearing it maybe sometime in May to discuss possible school closures, which will definitely be at the forefront of any superintendent's mind moving forward.
Well, Carly, some great stories you've had a chance to bring out in the Times here recently, and we appreciate you spending some time going through those with us here on Regionally Speaking today. And we should also mention, too, that like your colleague Will Racky, that this is your first opportunity to join us on Lakeshore Public Radio, and thanks for that, and we hope to have you back again to talk about some more education stories again real soon.
Absolutely, Chris. Thanks again for having us. We're always happy to speak about what's happening here in the region.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. University of St. Francis Professor Adam DeVille has written a new book that addresses the Catholic sex abuse scandal. A teacher of ecclesiology, Dr. DeVille believes that some of the solution could lie in other liturgical Christian traditions, specifically the Anglican and the Eastern Orthodox churches. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Green had a chance to sit down with him last month to talk about the book.
I am here in the studio with Dr. Adam DeVille. He's an associate professor and director of humanities at the University of St. Francis. Dr. DeVille, you came in today. We asked you to come in and talk about your new book. You teach ecclesiology, which is kind of the relationship between churches and faith groups.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about your book and who you wrote it for.
Yes, thank you. The book is called Everything Hidden Shall Be Revealed, Ridding the Church of Abuses of Sex and Power. And I really wrote it primarily for the Catholic Church, but drawing on the experience of Orthodox Christians and Anglican Christians as well, because I think both of them have something to offer the Catholic Church today as it's struggling to find ways to reform and to restructure itself in light of the ongoing sex abuse crisis.
What are some of those things that you have observed in the Anglican community and Eastern Orthodoxy that could offer some change to the Roman Catholic Church?
It's a really simple one that I think will be easy to implement in the Catholic world that both Anglicans and many Orthodox, especially the Armenians, do. And that is to have every parish, every local community is required to have a parish council. Currently in the Catholic world, they're optional. My book argues that they have to be mandatory, and they have to have both voice and vote for the people on the parish council, neither which exists right now in the Catholic world. And I do that because one of the big problems in the abuse crisis is the priests being moved around, shuffled around in secrecy, and nobody knows why, you know, Father so-and-so is here on Sunday of this week, and next week he's gone, and there's this new guy here. We don't know anything about why the old guy left, or why the new guy's here, or where he comes from. And that's how a lot of bishops dealt with the problem of abusive priests. They moved them around and didn't tell anybody. So one of the proposals I argue is you now have to have the parish council be told why this priest is leaving and be told about the background of the new guy coming in so that there's no more of this shuffling people around in secrecy. The bishops have to be held accountable to the people because the people have a right to know who their pastors are and what their background is.
That seems like a very simple solution, and it kind of comes as news to me that many Roman Catholic churches do not have a parish council. When we think of a parish council, would you have in mind a one that is made up of both men and women?
Absolutely. Many parishes in the Catholic world today do have parish councils, but they're optional. And the priest doesn't have to have one in the first place, and he doesn't have to listen to them, even if he does have one. So I argue they're no longer optional, they're mandatory. And they have the right of voice and vote, so the priest can't ignore them or sideline them. And I do that because too often they have been ignored, too often they have been sidelined. And so they are given now the responsibility for looking at problems within the parish. And I argue that this has to be balanced. I don't get into really fine details about how many, for example, but if you take, you know, your average committee of, say, 10 people, I think there's no reason why it shouldn't be 50-50 men and women on the parish council, working with the priest and with the bishop, so that all three of these, you know, the bishops, the priests, and the people have a responsibility for the communities that they're a part of.
What are some other potential solutions you've identified to kind of break this cycle that seems to kind of every 15 years or so, there's like another wave of Absolutely. Allegations,
yep.
and they seem almost more horrific than the wave before.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so I start with the parish, start with the local parish council proposal, because that's closest to home, and then I move up to successive levels. I move up to the regional or the diocesan levels, as it's called, to argue a similar change there, that people in the parishes and parish clergy have to be involved in the governance of the local diocese. Including something that we haven't seen in the Catholic world for over 100 years, but we still have in Anglicanism and Orthodoxy, which is the election of bishops. There's no reason why bishops can't be elected locally and held accountable to their people. And I lay forth a proposal in that book how that's happened in the Catholic world in the past, how it still happens in the Orthodox and Anglican worlds today, and why that's an important piece for Catholics to consider. No longer do you have these bishops able to get around accountability, but now they have to face their people, they have to be elected by their people, and they're accountable to their people for what they do and don't do when it comes to abuse, but really to any other issues as well, financial mismanagement and so on.
What are some other structural changes that you would recommend? You know, the Catholic Church is large mm-hmm. and vast mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Very top-down.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and in fact, I start with that in the first chapter of the book. I say that the biggest change that we need to begin with is psychological. We need to think differently about how we imagine the church because of the top-down focus, because of this heavy personality cult that's developed around the popes for the last 200 years. I argue that we have to stop this focus on the Pope, stop standing around waiting for him to tell us what to do, waiting for him to say, well, you can do this and not this. And take the initiative to do things locally and regionally without waiting for either a yes or a no from Rome. Because, in fact, that's not his job in the first place. And we've allowed him to get away with these kind of power grabs. And, in fact, a lot of us have liked that. You know, if you recall back even to November of last year when the American bishops met, stood around and did nothing because they said, well, we can't hold each other accountable. It's the Pope's job, you know. Well, there's one pope in the world, and there's 3,500 bishops. How much do you think he's going to have time to stand around and look at what 3,500 bishops are doing? He doesn't. He can't. You know, organizational theorists tell us today, you know, direct reports, right? When you're holding people accountable, 12 is the absolute maximum most of the experts recommend, because you can't do a good job supervising people more than that. So we need the local structures to hold these people accountable, bishops holding each other accountable, and the people holding the bishops and the clergy accountable, because the idea that we've got to wait for the Pope to do that is a fool's errand.
Where can people find it if they want to secure a copy?
It's all over Amazon, and then it's available at Angelico Press's website as well, which is just angelicopress.com. But as I say, Amazon is kind of the place to start.
And it's everything...
Everything hidden shall be revealed, ridding the church of abuses of sex and power.
Dr. DeVille, thank you so much for coming by and
You're
talking
welcome.
To us today.
You're very welcome.
Grade school students got to put their entrepreneurship skills to the test at Purdue University on Wednesday. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton tells us, the Classroom Business Enterprise Program helps teach kids about the basics of running a business.
Tables of handmade goods were on display as students described the small businesses they started.
We made about $500.
Mayflower Mill Elementary School third grader David Rowe helped create a Christmas-themed business, Rudolph Candygrams.
I enjoy that we're not in the classroom and we're on a something you don't get to do every day experience.
Purdue Center for Economic Education Director Tim Moore says the program gives students a chance to learn financial literacy and the basics of running a business.
Everyone has to work out how to budget. It just helps generally with their math skills.
Three schools from Lafayette and Frankfurt participated in the program this year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
Each year, Academy of American Poets recognizes the month of April as National Poetry Month. It's a time to celebrate poets and their craft.
I'm Robert Polito, president of the Poetry Foundation, and this is Poetry Now. I think I'm always on both sides of an issue when I write a poem.
Today's poet is Ray Armantrout. Her new poem, Life's Work, examines not only life and work, but also the arguments we have with ourselves and some of the contradictions we embody.
Did I say I was a creature of habit? I meant the opposite.
I think I often argue with myself in poems. Rhetoric is an argument we have with other people, and poetry is an argument we have with ourselves.
I've never been an old woman knitting by a fire, but I've played one in images.
In poetry, at least in my poetry, there's a lot of indirection, too, and maybe some deceitfulness.
Did I say I was a creature of habit? I meant the opposite. I meant behavior is a pile of clothes I might or might not wear. Before all the sowing and reaping could go on for centuries, before the calendar, I must have been convinced that my movements were both mandated and blessed. I've never been an old woman knitting by a fire, but I've played one in images where it meant being foolish or wise, a mistress of distractions, indirection. To rock while entwining is life's work, but I am reckless, restless. So I think I'm always on both sides of an issue when I write a poem. Did I say I was a creature of habit?
I think that holding two contradictory ideas in your mind at the same time is what poetry is good at.
I meant behavior is a pile of clothes I might or might not wear.
The poem starts off with this kind of perverse oppositional voice who wants to reject custom. In the first half, she goes from being kind of sassy, rebellious, to being accepting. In the second half, it's moves in the opposite direction.
I've never been an old woman knitting by a fire, but I've played one in images where it meant being foolish or wise, a mistress of distractions, indirection.
I never write about artworks. Nancy Spector from the Guggenheim in New York wrote to me and asked me to write something. I went through and picked a sculpture called Ruth by Powell Altimer. All of Altimer's figures have these plaster masks, and they're all human figures made of kind of white plastic winding tape over steel. They look sort of like mummies, but they're going about very ordinary tasks. When I started writing Life's Work, I didn't really realize that I was actually writing for the sculpture. I started with the lines, I've never been an old woman knitting by a fire. And then I thought about the sculpture. She's looking down at what looks like a sewing basket on the ground. There are some scissors. Then I started thinking about it in a different way. You know, that knitting things together, whether it's bones or ideas, is life's work and also sort of poetry's work. Life's work. Did I say I was a creature of habit? I meant the opposite. I meant behavior is a pile of clothes I might or might not wear. Before all the sowing and reaping could go on for centuries, before the calendar, I must have been convinced that my movements were both mandated and blessed. I've never been an old woman knitting by a fire, but I've played one in images where it meant being foolish or wise, a mistress of distractions, indirection. To rock while entwining is life's work, but I am reckless, restless.
That was Ray Armantrout with her new poem, Life's Work. To learn more about poetry now, please visit our website, poetryfoundation.org. For Poetry Now, I'm Robert Polito. This is the WFMT Radio Network, Chicago.
And this is it for Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us today. And our thanks to reporters from The Times, Will Racky and Carly Lanich. And from the Post-Tribune, Greg Tejeda for joining us on Reporters Roundtable Thursday. And we'll be back on Monday when we start bringing you some conversations with Northwest Indiana State legislators as they begin to check in on their work this session.